All right. Morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. And, yeah, we're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, the great Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive for this Monday morning. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We are going to talk about, we're going to rank the Star Trek movies, all of them. Talk a little bit about that and more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. 312-981-7200. If you have any space-related questions and you would like to have them answered, our good friend Rod Pyle is joining us this morning. So if you want to jump in with a space-related question, talk or text at 312-981-7200. Award-winning author, filmmaker, speaker on space. His latest books, Interplanetary Robots, True Stories of Space Exploration, and Space 2.0, are available for pre-order now. You can check out pylebooks.com, P-Y-L-E, pylebooks.com for more information. And let's welcome Rod back to the show. Rod, welcome back.
Good morning, Nick. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm good. A little tired, but I bet I'm not as tired as you.
Yeah. No, I'm okay. I'm good. And, you know, we wanted to have you on to talk about the Super Blood Wolf Moon, as they're calling it. Super Blood Wolf Moon is they're calling it. Now, we were not able to see, at least here in Chicago, I was not able to see it. We had snow and clouds all over the place, so I have not been able to take a look at it yet. Tell us all about the Super Blood Wolf Moon.
So first, let's break down this name, which the press has just been having a field day with.
Okay.
So the blood part has to do with, I mean, all lunar eclipses are red, because this is the solar eclipse, the moon passes between the sun and the earth, and it blocks out the sun. A lunar eclipse, the opposite, the moon passes behind the earth, goes into shadow. It's much longer. You know, totality lasts for an hour, that red phase. So because it's dipping into the shadow behind the earth, the longer red wavelengths of light are the ones that don't get scattered by the atmosphere, and they get bent around the earth, and so they bathe the moon in this red light. Because the moon is a little closer on this eclipse, it went a little deeper into that shadow, and made for this kind of darker gray red, which is where you get the blood part from. Wolf moon is just the first full moon in January, so that's not that big a deal.
Okay.
So yeah, so it didn't sound. It's not quite as exciting as it sounds. You know, it didn't get us all out in our front yards howling and undressing in the cold or anything. So yeah, it was cool. I didn't have a chance to see much of it because I was doing this webcast with this group called Astronomers Without Borders, and I think Nat Geo picked it up, but. I did get out there and get a few looks at it, and we had cloud problems here too, but it's pretty spectacular. You know, all lunar eclipses are neat. They're very relaxed in the right conditions. If you're not Chicago or the summer, you can go out and set up a lawn chair and just kind of enjoy it for as long as it takes. So it goes into gray part first, and then red, and then gray again, and then exits. So it was a lot of fun to see, and I hope you get to see the next one. There was somebody live streaming on Facebook from Chicago who had a pretty clear shot. So you must just had regional clouds there, I'm guessing.
Yeah, we did. Because like last night when the first chance that I had to see it, we got snow coming out of the sky and everything. So there were clouds everywhere and I didn't get a chance to see it. how often does this happen?
Well, lunar eclipses happen, I guess, about every year and a half at least. But this one was weird because the supermoon part is about 20,000 miles closer to Earth, which is almost a tenth of its distance, if you think about it, 240,000 miles. So something that big won't happen again. I think this full combination is another press item. You know, it'll be 10 years before it happens again, but there'll be another good lunar eclipse in about three, so they're not that rare. Solar eclipses are the tough ones, and we've talked about that before. You know, if you ever get a chance to drop everything and go run and see a solar eclipse, that's truly a life-altering event. Lunar eclipses are kind of a year-altering event, I guess.
And according to this, it says for the Chicago area, this will be the last visible total eclipse until May 15th, 2022.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's about 3 years, right?
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah.
Yeah, so you'll have another chance. You'll still be around.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, who names these? How did Wolf Moon become the first full moon in January? Why is it a wolf moon?
It, the wolf moon part, like I said, the wolf moon just means first full moon in January. I think this goes back to the days of poor Richard's almanac and that kind of thing, probably earlier than that. But it's like, Anglo culture back into the probably 14th, 15th century or something. And these things just come along. I don't know if it has any Native American roots or not. I think this is all European. But I didn't really look into it that deeply. I just wanted to figure out what the heck each of those terms meant, because they seem to get longer every year.
Yeah.
You know, next one's going to be Super Blood Wolf Howling Disco of the 80s Hair Band Moon or something. And I'm going to have to sit there and pick that one apart, and that's going to be a real drill.
Yeah. Well, so the Super Blood Wolf Moon, and I will say this, on my news feed, at least in the social media, a lot of people posted pictures. A lot of people were taking a look at it. There were moon pictures all over my news feed.
Well, and it used to be, if you had a telescope, you had to lug your telescope out, and then you had to get out your SLR camera and an adapter. And if you wanted to take, not for the moon, but for deep space pictures, you'd chill the film down and all this kind of stuff. Now there are adapters so you can just hook your iPhone up to a smaller telescope and get a perfectly decent picture. You saw a lot of pictures, probably big red fuzzy balls, because an iPhone was just, a smartphone was maxed out on its telephoto and tried desperately to focus on something. So those weren't so great. They're pretty grainy and nasty. But if you get even just a basic telescope, because the moon's so close and so large and so bright, you can shoot it with almost anything. So it's really fun to go out and get those pictures. I actually tried with a pair of binoculars, but I didn't have enough hands, so that didn't work out.
Oh, okay. All right. All right. Well, there it is, the Super Blood Wolf Moon. A little information about that. But by the way, tell everybody, Rod, about yourself. Give you a little background on Rod Pyle.
I'm one of those guys that grew up in the space age. I'm 62 now, so I was just the right age to really enjoy all that stuff. So I kind of became aware of this during Gemini and then certainly during the Apollo years. And that was just the greatest adventure I'd ever seen. So while the other kids were grooving on sports, I was staying home from school watching moonwalks as much as you could before the networks broke in. Unbelievably to me, with reruns of I Love Lucy and General Hospital, I just thought that was a crime.
Yeah.
And then, we went in the Skylab era and the shuttle era. That was all still really engaging, but I got off in other pursuits. But then in 2005, I had a chance to write a book about the Apollo program, which I just heard, the publisher didn't tell me, but I just heard that's being reissued too. So everything I've ever written that had anything to do with the moon is coming out again in 2019, with or without my help, apparently. And it just became this real treasure, because I'd made TV documentaries, but you have to tell the whole history of the space race in 44 minutes, and it's kind of like writing TV guide blurbs or tweets or something.
Yeah.
So the fact that you can get into a book and really just kind of roll around and soak it all up and have fun with it is great, and it's, like I've said many times to you, it's got to be almost as much fun as radio.
Yeah, not quite. Not quite.
Okay, nothing's as much fun as radio.
So, Rod, speaking of the moon, China, they wanted to grow some plants on the moon. Tell me a little bit about what's going on there.
So this is the Chang'e 4, or Chang'e, if you pronounce it the Chinese way, 4 lander that landed on the far side of the moon, not the dark side. It goes through phases just like the near side. But because one side of the moon always faces this, it's what's called tidally locked. There apparently is a mass offset of some kind that causes it to be gravitationally attracted to the Earth on the front side. The back side is very different, much more cratered, much more beat up, completely unexplored except from orbit, people shooting photos. So China had kind of been pacing the space race years of the 60s and doing what we in the Soviet Union had done back then at a slower pace. So it's about 2003. And then this is the first real deviation from that path. This is something new. We looked at it. I think the Soviets looked at it back in the 60s. I'm trying to put something on the far side. In fact, one of the Apollo missions is even considered to go to the far side. But one of the big problems is, besides the fact that we don't know that much about it, is that the moon blocks all radio transmissions. So you have to put a satellite up in a stationary orbit beyond the moon to relay these signals. So they did that successfully, and then the lander, the spacecraft went into orbit in mid-December, and then the lander came down in January 1st, Beijing time. And it's a stationary lander and a rover. And then they had solicited a bunch of experiments from universities around the country, and one of them was, let's put a bunch of plants and some insects in this pressurized canister and put it up there and see what happens. So what you're looking for is reactions to temperature and lunar environment, which are pretty predictable. It gets really cold, down to about minus 250, so things are going to die. But they want to see how plants that might be possible agricultural crops for a future lunar colony would do, particularly because the radiation out there is vicious. It's on the order of 600 times what you get underneath the Earth's protective magnetosphere and atmosphere. So that was a big part of it. What's puzzling, and all the Western press accounts I've read about this have said the same thing, that they're presuming that the experiment was designed to end after a few weeks when lunar night came to that side of the moon, which lasts for 2 weeks because the temperatures would plunge. But what puzzles me about that is they had fruit flies up there as part of that experiment. And fruit flies are very promiscuous, and they reproduce quickly, so you can study mutations and so forth, but not in that short a period of time. So I'm really wondering if there were heaters along for the ride that didn't, for some reason, switch on or function, and that's why, because it went down to minus 62 degrees and everything died. And that's all they've said. So I think this may be one of those kind of limited news release things, but it's still exciting that they did it. And hopefully that probe, so far they haven't had the kind of luck that JPL has in engineering with these things lasting a long time. I think the first rover lasted about 3 weeks or a month. But they're getting better at it, and we should be getting results from this for a good long while. And part of what they're looking at, the next mission, which is supposed to happen later this year, Chang'e 5, will bring back lunar samples. They'll be the third country to do that after us and the Soviet Union. And then after that, they want to build up kind of a robotic base down near the South Lunar Pole and have an assembly of machines so they can do long-term exploration planning for this human mission that they want to do in the late 2020s.
Oh, all right. Okay. Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
All right, a few more stories here that Rod's going to talk about, and he is a space expert. His latest books are Interplanetary Robots and Space 2.0. You can check out PileBooks.com for more information. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. More with Rod right after we break here on 720 WGN. All right. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 o'clock. Steve Grzanich coming up with the opening bell at 5. And also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. Our good friend Rod Pyle is with us, an award-winning author and an expert on space. And he's here to talk about some of the latest space stories. And we were talking about the Super Blood Wolf Moon a little earlier. Let's welcome Rod back. Rod, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, let's talk about this artificial meteor shower. What do we got going here?
This is a really cool story. So on, I think it was Sunday night, Japan launched a rocket. They have a slightly smaller fleet than ours, but a number of very capable rockets. They launched a rocket carrying a big science and engineering satellite. And the primary mission was for that satellite to test all these new spaceflight technologies that they've been developing. So advanced propulsion and better solar panels and a new star tracker for navigating in space and things like that. But it also carried these six little CubeSats. This is becoming much more common now that these larger boosters will carry a primary payload and then a bunch of secondary ones. So I think the record was held by India. It launched 101 CubeSats out of one rocket. So these six CubeSats, they're about the size of a shoebox, a little smaller, contain a bunch of pellets. And they won't tell us what the pellets are made of, but some proprietary mix that they guarantee us is non-toxic, not that it really matters at that altitude. And they're like shotgun shells. So these things, it will be timed out so that they'll dip lower in their orbits. They have little parachutes, so there's just enough drag up there to bring them down to a lower orbit. And then a door pops open, and these pellets get popped out, and there's dozens of them, and they're only about a third of an inch in diameter. But the average shooting star you see is about the size of a large grain of sand, certainly smaller than a pea. So they're going to create this spectacular man-made meteor shower, and they can time it to be over a certain region and do it pretty much whenever they want within about 40 minutes either way, given the mechanics of the orbit. So this is an entertainment company. And this is going to be, they have some science goals, but their main reason for being is to create these special entertainment events, which should be pretty spectacular.
That's pretty cool. And the name of the company is Astro Live Experiences.
Yeah. What's in the name, right?
Yeah.
It's a Japanese company. And I think what kind of compels me about this, I mean, this in itself is really interesting, but you know, I think as launch costs come down, these private operators begin sending their rockets up more and more frequently and charging less to do so, you're going to see more of these kinds of non-essential, quote-unquote, non-science and engineering missions. Probably you'll start seeing orbital advertising. There's been a lot of dissent about, you know, because you can now get a whole constellation of lit satellites, dozens, even hundreds of them, to fly in formation if you want. But if you do that, now you've got orbiting billboards, and you can see a Pepsi ad up there every night for, you know, the minutes that it takes to go overhead. Most of us don't want to, but that's something that, that may start happening, and you could even someday see something on the moon doing that, and it would probably all be in the good old name of advertising. So that's kind of a weird one. The final part about this is there is some scientific interest because they're able to trigger this meteor shower on demand. They're able to track the trajectory of the pellets and see exactly what angle they enter the atmosphere and so forth and how long it takes them to burn and all that, what temperatures they are. So it gives them kind of a control base to be able to get more data about how that whole thing works.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
It's neat.
Yeah, that's really cool. I mean, you know, and the technology. Now, how often are they going to do this?
They haven't said. I think they've got another flight scheduled to go up later in the year. But I don't know if they're going to release all six of these at once for this first one or if they're staged in some way. They had announced the time. It would be visible over Japan only, of course, a little further than that. So that part I don't know. But I think if this works and if people get interested and if the costs are low enough, you'll be able to see this happening more and more often. Because imagine your corporate retreat. It's like, okay, everybody step outside. It's a nice summer night. And God's fireworks are going to start in the sky at about 5 minutes. I mean, that's a pretty cool deal.
That is cool. That's very, very cool. Is anybody, you know, in America working on this kind of technology?
I know there's people working on these kinds of programs in general terms. I hadn't heard anybody doing anything about, you know, bespoke meteor showers. But I know, like I said, there's the talk about various forms of orbital advertising and so forth. So there are certainly companies doing this. The question is how many of them will come to fruition. You know, Japan is an interesting country. If you spend any time there, it's like the whole thing about fembots. You know, why are all fembots 25-year-old Japanese females? It's just what they do. So they kind of focus on these cool and unusual and unique things, and I guess this is going to be one of them. So this is where it seems to have popped up first, and hopefully will be next because it's kind of fun.
Yeah, that's very cool. Hey, I got a couple of texts here, Rod.
Okay.
Dave in Monroe, Wisconsin, simply asks, when will man land on Mars?
That's a really good question. If you listen to Elon Musk sometime around 2024 to 2026, we all think that's pretty ambitious and optimistic. If you listen to NASA sometime in the mid to late 2030s, if you listen to China sometime in the early 2040s, you know, there's a lot of problems with that. One is how long it takes to get there, and you got to protect people all the way out there from radiation and other mishaps that can happen from the technology. So we've been talking about it for decades, but the more we find out about the space between planets and the environment on Mars, the further the goal seems to get away because it's just a really hostile place. Mm. There's a lot of radiation out there. There are a lot of other obstacles, and then the Martian surface itself is pretty nasty. Even the soil is toxic. So they got to work all that stuff out before you can just get up there and step on it. And finally, there's the concern about contamination. We're concerned about bringing back some kind of monsters from the planet, probably in the form of microbes that can do damage to us.
Yeah.
But more recently, there's been concern about what Earth microbes will do once they're on the Martian surface. And everybody carries them, no matter how much you try and clean things. So there's a movement of trying to keep Mars pure, and we're going to have to figure out how we're going to deal with that.
Mm, okay. Lots of variables there, for sure.
Yes.
218 area code says, do you ever think we'll figure out a way for us as a species to leave our solar system, or do you think that that kind of space travel is just not possible and we're stuck here?
I was just writing about that. You know, there's so many interesting things happening there. They're not being developed right now, but there's a lot of discussion about it and forward-looking ideas about technology that could be developed. So you've either got to have a generational ship where people procreate and breed, and it takes tens or hundreds of years to get there, depending on what kind of propulsion system you're using, or you got to put people into deep sleep, or you just send a bunch of DNA up there and then sort of respawn the human race on the other end, which would probably be one of the closer star systems like Alpha Centauri, because that's only, quote unquote, four light years away, which is many trillions of miles. Or one of the ones I find the most compelling is this kind of transhumanism argument, where you take human consciousness and you put it in some kind of machine, little mechanical cockroach is my favorite because they're light, they're small, they're indestructible, and now you can go exploring anywhere. You're just not very good looking while you're doing it, and you're still getting the data back and kind of having this sort of virtual existence out there. So it's a huge conversation. I cover a little bit of it in the Space 2.0 book, but it's something that really deserves a book of its own, and I know that people like Michio Kaku have written about it. So that's the big, broad, sweeping answer.
Okay. All right. So your books, really quickly, tell us about Interplanetary Robots, True Stories of a Space Exploration.
So that book is really, it's kind of JPL-centric, but it's also got a lot of stories in the Soviet Union. So it's kind of looking at the space, sort of the sequel to my Amazing Stories of Space Age book, which is about human spaceflight. This is the machine side. So all the way from the very first launch of Sputnik up through the end of the Cassini mission, I just wanted to look at all the amazing robotic programs they had had and a bunch of them that were designed that didn't fly. For instance, there was an early idea about sending this life science laboratory up to Mars in the early 1960s, which was also called Voyager. That name was then recycled for the Outer Planets mission. And it was so big it would have to be launched on a Saturn V, so it was kind of like taking your Winnebago up to Mars to look for life. So that one obviously didn't fly.
Right.
So that's the gist of it.
All right. And then the other one that you just mentioned, Space 2.0.
That was a longer effort. I interviewed about 40 people from various governments and U.S. government agencies and private spaceflight companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic and so forth to really just try and get a grasp on what we're looking at over the next 20 years. So it's a look at both the international programs, domestic government programs, foreign government programs, and the private sector, and try to find out where the sweet spot is between all these different endeavors. You know, how do you blend them in such a way that you can get out there quickly and effectively and affordably and build some kind of infrastructure so you start really mining the riches of the solar system, which is substantial, and begin seeing a financial return, and then ultimately try to settle space with human beings.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. Rod, always a pleasure to have you on, man. Thank you for all the insight, and thank you for giving us a little bit background information on the Super Blood Wolf Moon.
So. Okay.
All right. Rod, hey, by the way, Rod, do you have a favorite Star Trek movie?
I think Star Trek 2, hands down. You know, they always say the odd ones are the best. I enjoyed 1. I'm not sure anybody else did.
Yeah.
4 was fun, but it wasn't really a Star Trek movie, I guess, not the way we think of it. The new ones, I got real mixed feelings about them.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, we're going to dive into that after the news. We're going to talk about the Star Trek movies. Nerdist ranked them from best to worst. So we're going to
I'll bring up your feed.
Okay. Thanks, Rod.
Thanks.
Always a pleasure, buddy. Rod Pyle, everybody. Check out pilebooks.com. News is up next.